Nearly 71% of the Earth's surface is covered in water. And yet, even in modern times, we have still not been able to develop the ability to provide clean water to those who desire on the other 29% of the Earth. But it's not just a problem which third world countries are encountering. I'm Skynell Hughes, and on this episode, we are going to give you the 360 view of why clean water is increasingly becoming a first world problem. Let's get started. Every year, nearly 1.1 billion people lack access to fresh water, with 2.7 billion of the global population finding clean water scarce at least 1 month per year. Now, increase in demand by a growing population, mixed with poor management, pollution, lack of infrastructure, and of course, climate change, are key elements which affect the availability of fresh water to various regions of the world. Now, while countries in the Middle East like Qatar, Israel, Lebanon, and Iran are most prone to a water crisis. Despite technology, first world countries in other regions are seeing an increase in their inability to provide fresh water for all of their citizens. Well, it's a far stretch to say that our world will ever run out of water. The ability to purify it and make it easily available is a continuing challenge, which has more to do with poor management and decisions by those in power than a result of nature. In fact, the blame for the six major examples of water crisis currently being faced in the United States falls not on Mother Nature, rather on mankind. Joining me now for more on all of this is Jim Olson. Now, Jim is a lawyer and public water rights advocate. Welcome. Now, we reached out to you because in the USA, we are seeing yet another water crisis in a predominantly African-American community, this time Jackson, Mississippi, where flooding from climate change strained an already underfunded and neglected municipal water infrastructure, all to create another crisis with citizens without water relying on bottled. Now, like in Flint, Michigan, a cynical attempt to save money led to a public health crisis with a generational legacy of destruction. And prior to that, we had Detroit, where a city's bankruptcy problem led to city officials cutting off water to residents who couldn't pay their water bills. What's the common issue with all three municipalities in terms of delivering safe drinking water to their residences?
And the real question is why? I think there's several factors. One is, at least in the United States, when we began to shift to solutions in the marketplace, we shifted away from more affirmative government action and took on, I think, even in government, sort of a business attitude towards governance. So in that climate that evolved over the last 40 years, at least in this country since the Reagan administration, intensified more in the 90s and certainly more in the last two decades, we've seen this permeate all kinds of what were once public services, education privatized, prisons privatized, healthcare privatized, somewhat in the energy field, but less so because of public utility regulation. And I think that shift in governance has affected water services. I think it's affected more than water services. I think it's affected the way we address water problems on the planet right now. The other thing is that I don't think there has been an understanding of what the role of delivering water really is. It has taken three decades for those around the world fighting in the UN for a human right to water, ultimately accomplished in 2010 with the work of the Blue Planet Project, Water Warriors, and Food and Water Watch, and Council of the Canadians, led by Maud Barlow, who was instrumental in achieving that great landmark. But the human right to water at the UN doesn't necessarily translate to what happens in Jackson, Mississippi, or what happened in Jackson, Mississippi and continues today, or the Detroit shutoffs that began in 2014. Or the Flint lead crisis. And let me add one more, as long as we're talking in the Michigan Great Lakes region, the algal bloom crisis in the western one third of Lake Erie. We have one of the Great Lakes, the western one third, experiencing serious algal blooms for the last 8-9 years. And there's been no government action that has adequately addressed that problem. And 400,000 people were shut off from the water supply a couple of years ago because of the toxicity of these blooms. So what government has done is they see their utility water service, and I'm just going to talk about water service now and not the bigger water issues on the planet, unless you'd like to do so, and maybe I'll talk about what's called the public trust doctrine. But I think what we do, we shifted in this water delivery as a product, and people are customers. Well, that's a contractual relationship, and I suppose you have contractual rights, but it doesn't mean that you have some fundamental right. It's only as good as the contract, and your remedies are only as good as the contract. And what we're lacking is an understanding of what the role of government and governance is when we're dealing with water on this planet. And every time we see a crisis like this, this lack of attention that you mentioned shows up as one of the fundamental, if not the fundamental cause of the problem, or at least the cause of the continuing problem after we become aware of it, like what happened in the flooding in Jackson, Mississippi. But it's all over the world. I mean, just think of what's going on in Pakistan and elsewhere.
If we are seeing the effects of climate change most dramatically, as we saw in Pakistan, and 10 million are displaced, and closer to home, flooding in Houston, why is the right to safe drinking water being addressed as part of a discussion of climate change? And much of the focus has been on fossil fuel pollution, but little is actually discussed about floods and the impact on water.
I think the problem is that we don't view climate change as a water issue. And if we did, look, we live in a hydrosphere. I, if you want me to put some slides up, I will, but if we don't have time, I won't. I'll just describe it. We live in a hydrosphere. The water evaporates, it moves in water in the sky and clouds, and it gets cold and condenses. It comes to the earth, it runs over the land, it's runoff, it goes into the groundwater, it creates lakes and springs and rivers and streams and rivers and oceans, and goes around and around in plants and roots and transfer evaporation. It's a cycle. And every arc of that cycle, sooner or later, becomes crucial to every person on the planet and all life on the planet. But so climate is a hydrospheric issue. It's a water issue. It is as greenhouse gas emissions, but we're so focused on emissions, we're not focused on the fact that it's disturbing the entire hydrosphere and all the water on the planet in various times, in various places, causing these upheavals. So we need to understand that this is a public water issue planet-wide. The other thing we need to understand when you get to the Jackson, Mississippi issues is that we can't sit idly by in the face of changing climate. And we know the weather is becoming more and more extreme. We've known it for 20 or 30 years. In the last decade, it's been more, well, beginning with Hurricane Katrina, we understand that this is a very serious problem, and it's getting worse. And as those things intensify, the inaction of Jackson, Mississippi's, or any government, any state government and the federal government, the inaction of not beginning to understand that everything we designed in the past is obsolete. We're living in the 21st century. And the public trust doctrine I mentioned is a 21st century principle. Yes, its roots are 2000 years ago, but the fact is this is a 21st century issue. And this doctrine addresses the obsolescence of the law, the obsolescence of responsibility, and the inaction of understanding that we live on a water cycle and that climate change is a water issue.
What is the public trust doctrine, and why is something that was created back in the 70s even relevant today? You know, I'm kind of wondering how it was used in your case against Nestle, and what changed and what's going on?
Yes, I mean, the case is reported in the, for those that are interested, it's reported in the Michigan Court of Appeals reports that are published by most states, and particularly Michigan. It's in the volume 269, Michigan App, it's called. The case involved Nestle moving into Michigan and selecting an area that they thought was robust of groundwater, but they were selling spring water, so it was connected to a spring, and the company had to demonstrate that to put spring water, their marketing niche, spring water on the bottle, they had to demonstrate that every gallon out of the watershed for it going in the bottle was a gallon out of the spring. Well, the spring formed their stream. And the lake and the lakes, and their pumping reduced the stream anywhere from 18 to 35%, depending on the time of the year. And we were able to file a lawsuit both under common law rights of people that live on water bodies and also groundwater law, but also the Michigan Environmental Protection Act, which Joe Sachs had drafted, creating rights of citizens to sue under this public trust doctrine, which they have. Because they're beneficiaries. You are a legal beneficiary, just like a trust in a bank. And so you have a right to correct these wrongs. And we were able to use those principles and demonstrate an impairment of the water system and a serious harm to the environment. And we're able to limit the pumping. What hasn't been addressed, and then we can get back to the public trust doctrine, what hasn't been addressed is the privatization issue. I mean, when you think about bottled water, it either comes from a private well or a municipal system. These companies get it one way or the other. Out of the ground, in most situations, nobody pays for it. They just take it under the right of what they call reasonable use in our country, or appropriate uses, but it's basically a reasonable use. And really, until bottled water came along, nobody really thought about the sale of water. There was the delivery of water in public water systems, but the sale of water is a reasonable use. You have a right to use the water, but the question is, do you have a right to sell it? Or if it's public water, does the sovereign through its legislature have to consent to that? And I think the answer is yes, they do. Interestingly enough, that would create a level playing field between citizens, the government, and those privatizing and profiting off the water. Again, bottled water is bottled water, but it should be under the umbrella of sovereign. It should be consented to by the sovereign. And the sovereign, therefore, should not be subsidizing the private profit. It should be shared. Municipal water systems that, for example, let's go back to Detroit, Aquafina and Dasani, Coke and Pepsi, they get their water from Detroit on a nonprofit cost basis. They put it in a bottle and they make the profit. And even though other users are sharing in that nonprofit basis, they share in the cost, nonprofit cost basis, they share in the cost, but they don't share in the profit. So it all goes to the company that says, well, we're using the water. Once we have it, it's ours. No, I don't think that's true. I think they're getting it from the public based on public expenditures to create that system to begin with. And they're being subsidized by everybody else, taxpayers of the state of Michigan. This is true worldwide. And we have to understand that this has to be corrected, this privatization of water through bottled water. Now, privatization of municipal systems is yet another issue, whether that's a solution or not. Most people have concluded that, you know, these major companies buying up municipal waters because Jackson Mississippi's of the world can no longer fix their systems. So, you know, larger companies that have the money will get the money and then compound the interest on these people along with profit on into the future. These are serious questions that need to be addressed in the context of the governance of water, public, and public trust.
Thank you so much. You know, that was Jim Olson, lawyer and public water rights advocate. All right, stick around, because when we come back, we will be joined by a guest, an expert on water rights out of India. Stay tuned.
No U.S. strategic national security interest in Ukraine at all. I would say there's no interest, U.S. interest in Ukraine, whereas it's very vital interest for the Russian Federation that Ukraine be restored to a neutral buffer state, separating it from NATO countries.
On cheap energy coming from Russia, Russian gas, cheap, and suppose affordable and secure and stable, which has been proved not the case. This is a world that is no longer there.
Before I pay 160, now become 300.
Все эти санкционные пакеты, они расширяют круг дефицитных товаров.
Подсолнечное масло вообще просто пропало, а неделями его не было.
И что дальше будет, никаких проблесков, скажем так, не видно. Наоборот, все хуже, хуже и хуже.
Why do you decide on sanctions? You sanction a country, you sanction a person, because you want to change the behavior of this government, of this person. Well, that hasn't happened. Sanctions haven't functioned.
Welcome back. Today we are discussing water crises that are plaguing Western countries, as well as developing nations. And so for a look beyond the borders of the U.S., we want to bring in Vandana Shiva. She is an environmentalist activist and author of the book Water Wars, and she joins us now from India. Thank you so much for being with us. You know, you've written this great book, Water Wars, Pollution, Privatization, and Profit, all back in 2002. Then it actually got reprinted in 2016. But a lot of the points it was making then are still being discussed, even debated. And we are seeing more and more privatization of water and corporate control of water. What are the state of discussions in the two decades since you wrote that book?
You know, I wrote the book in the early stages of privatization, including the privatization by default, when you take the water as a commons, you take a river that flows for all, and you use it to dump your pollution. That's one kind of privatization. The other kind of privatization is you take a river and divert it for hydroelectricity or for irrigation. So the water is the ultimate commons. And after I wrote that book, the pressure to privatize water increased intensively with help from the World Bank and the IMF. IMF was giving every country that was trapped in debt was being given a restructuring loan with water privatization as a core component. And if we hadn't had a movement of the International Forum on Globalization, and if we didn't build a movement against the patenting of seeds and the privatization of water, frankly, there would have been no free water. There would have been no communities to protect the water. So if you think of how bad things are, think of how much worse they would have been if we would not have had movements standing in defense of the water.
What is the state of things in India at the moment? Now, of course, I want to recognize it's a massive country that we're talking about. I know, for instance, places in the eastern part of India were getting hit decade after decade with climate change effects. Is that still the case, or are things actually improving?
Well, you know, if the pollution of the land and the atmosphere keeps increasing, of course, the disasters will keep increasing. The big super cyclone that you're mentioning was 1999, and it killed thousands of people. We've had more frequent cyclones since then and more intense cyclones. But after that super cyclone, the government of Orissa did amazing work in cyclone warnings and cyclone shelters. We have been saving seeds. And among the seeds that our community seed bank in Orissa had saved were seeds that could tolerate salt and flooding. And that was distributed with the Orissa supercyclone. And when the tsunami hit South India, the Bay of Bengal tsunami, the Orissa farmers gave the salt-tolerant and flood-tolerant seeds to the farmers of Tamil Nadu. So yeah, climate extremes are increasing, and all of the predictions are that South Asia, our subcontinent, will be the worst affected. And I have personally both done the research as well as movement building, first because we are the third pole. We have the maximum snows in the Himalaya after the North and South Pole, but the North and South Pole doesn't have a population. Our snows and our waters support half of humanity for drinking water. Now, the glacial melt is one impact. And we've seen a disaster in 2013 when heavy rain came, a glacier was melting, the building of huge hydroelectric projects had totally devastated the river, and the combination of the three things, intense rain, glacial melt, and maldevelopment, created a disaster that washed away 20,000 people. And 2021, in the source of the place where the beautiful movement which inspired me, CHIPCO, to protect the forest, and the women were saying, you destroy the forest in the catchments, you're going to get more landslides, you're going to get more floods, you're going to get more drought. Sadly, in 2021, that village was impacted because another glacier melted, another dam was being built, and 200 people were washed away. The second reason why we have huge impact is we are a totally monsoon-dependent economy. And destabilization of the monsoons, either by creating intense rain or lack of rain, is making our agriculture suffer, our people suffer. And then we have the longest coastline, more than 7,000 kilometers. And cyclones, sea level rise, coastal erosion are a third dimension of the impact that comes via climate havoc through water. I have said from the beginning, if at the end of the day, climate change impacts lives either through intense flooding or through drought. The temperature aspect is there, but it's not the most serious in terms of the impact on life and death in the immediate situation now.
Okay, so in situations like you were discussing, where you've got these massive climate change events happening across at the United Nations General Assembly, decisions in 2010 that recognizes water and sanitation as a human right and essential to human rights. How is that and those decisions where people agreed to them, where all the countries signed on to them, and how are those being addressed in any of the climate discussions that are underway at the moment?
I don't think water is being given the central role it should be given. Because what's the climate system? The climate system is the biosphere managing the climate. And when the climate is destabilized, the hydrological system is destabilized. But the same systems that are leading to emissions of greenhouse gases and fossil fuel pollution are water intensive systems that are anyway destroying the hydrological balance on the land. I did a book on the Green Revolution in Punjab. Now, Punjab is the land of five rivers. It should have no water crisis. This is why the Green Revolution was taken to Punjab. And in a few decades, it has, of course, destroyed the soil, it's destroyed the farming, it's created a cancer drain. But worst, it is leading to a water famine. When you use chemical agriculture, you use 10 times more water to produce the same amount of food. But worse, you create water pollution. The nitrate pollution is one of the most serious impacts, whether it's in local water bodies and streams, or it's the dead zones in the oceans, which are absolutely killing life. And then the nitrous oxide that comes from these synthetic fertilizers is 300 times more damaging than carbon dioxide. So whether it's the atmosphere or the dead zone or the dead soils and nutritionally empty food, we should be looking much more at how fossil agriculture has destroyed the water bodies. If you do an analysis of how did lakes dry up, like Lake Chad, or rivers dry up, it's because this chemical agriculture, the Green Revolution, including in Africa, the alliance of the Green Revolution, but pushed by Mr. Gates and Rockefeller, and sadly, at the COP27, Rockefeller destroyed India's Punjab is standing there with the Food and Agriculture Organization, looking at future solutions. For them, the future solution will be futures trading in water, which they've started. It will be treating water as a financial asset, which they've started. Rockefeller and the New York Stock Exchange have started talking about not allowing nature to have integrity, to reduce nature to a financial asset, and to allow the Black Rocks and the Vanguards to decide the future of water according to how you can trade it on it financially rather than protect it ecologically.
Thank you so much, Vandana Shiva, author of Water Wars. You know, sometimes in politics, I have to wonder, how low can politicians sink? And using a natural resource, which life depends on, is truly the definition of hitting rock bottom. You know, those in government of an area which finds itself facing a water crisis have failed to do one of the key tasks of their position. And if they cannot be held accountable by a court of law, they at least should be held accountable by the ballot box. For those countries who face a water crisis because of physical water scarcity and the lack of water to meet all demands, others should be compelled to step in and help resolve. However, when the problem is actually poor decision-making by those in power, no grace should be given. However, oftentimes, those same folks make decisions which allow the problem to purposely persist while crying in front of the cameras at the injustice. You know, this display of hypocrisy is nothing new. However, in today's modern-day society, it should be unacceptable. If we have the ability to put a man on the moon, to find cures to diseases, then we are fools if we continue to repeat the same issues which cause such danger to our most vulnerable communities. As more light is being shown, demand action rather than just words from the politicians. And most importantly, demand accountability, results, and accept no excuses. I'm Skynell Hughes, and thank you for watching this edition of 360 View. Until next time.